or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello and good evening. This is Don Swans, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the May 17th issue of the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Front page, 11 winners and losers of oil's new world order. It's written by Jason Bordoff, a regular contributor. The war in Iran has triggered the largest oil supply disruption in modern history. The crisis in the Strait of Hormuz is forcing governments to redefine energy security for an age of geopolitical fragmentation, one in which resilience depends not only on how much oil the world produces, but also where it flows, who can get it, and which countries are able to absorb the shock when it is interrupted. Nearly 15% of global oil supply has been removed from the market. Crude prices remain elevated above $100 a barrel after initially spiking higher. They will very likely move sharply higher as inventories run dry. But while the oil market is global and rising costs are felt everywhere, the consequences are not evenly distributed. Asia has been hit first and hardest. Last year, the region relied on the Middle East for nearly 60% of its imported oil. The disruption has been particularly severe, not just for the crude, but also for refined products like diesel and jet fuel, which have doubled in price since January. In wealthier countries, pricier oil generally shows up first as inflation and weaker growth. In lower-income importing countries, it's manifest as shortages. Bangladesh has limited air conditioning to a balmy 77 degrees. Laos has shortened the school week from 5 days to 3. Sri Lanka made Wednesday a public holiday. In Pakistan, cricket teams are playing to empty stadiums, or fans are urged to watch from home rather than travel. Shale production, which sharply curbed U.S. oil imports from the Middle East since its boom starting in the 2000s, has so far shielded the U.S. to a degree. But gasoline prices have already risen to more than $4.50 a gallon from under $3 before the war, costing the average household more than $150 a month. The most consequential effects of the crisis, however, may not be in the immediate price spike around the world, but the strategic policy shifts they prompt. Just as nations dramatically rethought energy policy after the oil crisis of the 1970s, a disruption of this scale will force governments around the world to rethink energy strategy. Here's how. The U.S., insulated but not immune. 2 decades ago, the U.S. imported around 60% of the oil it consumed. Today, it's the world's largest oil producer, and a major net exporter. Oil use as a share of the economy has also steadily fallen in recent decades. The surge in supply means that physical shortages will take longer to reach American shores. Consumers are paying more at the pump, but the broader macroeconomic damage is smaller because increased consumer spending at the pump now flows to domestic producers rather than abroad. Plus, natural gas prices surged in Europe and Asia, but barely rose in the U.S., a price divergence that has saved U.S. consumers trillions since the onset of the shale revolution. Long view. In a global market, American consumers still pay higher prices at the pump when a supply disruption occurs overseas, and there are relatively few tools to mitigate disruptions of this scale. As prices rise, politicians may be tempted to embrace more extreme and economically and geopolitically harmful options, such as banning oil exports. Longer term, today's crisis holds at least the promise of forging more common ground, as it is both true that American position has been strengthened by producing more oil and gas, and that the U.S. would still be less vulnerable to supply shocks if we used less oil through tighter fuel economy standards, more electric vehicles, and better mass transit and rail. Canada and Mexico, a need for diversification. As a major oil and gas explorer, Canada is better positioned than most other countries. According to Goldman Sachs, Canada is among the economies that stand to see the largest GDP gain from higher oil prices. Mexico is in a tougher spot. It produces crude, but declining output and limited refining capacity leave it dependent on imported gasoline and diesel, much of it from the U.S. That makes Mexico vulnerable, not just to global crude prices, but also to refined product shortages, Gulf Coast price spikes, and the risk that U.S. domestic politics revives calls for restricting fuel exports. The crisis may strengthen the case in both countries for long-delayed efforts to reach markets beyond the U.S., such as a pipeline to the West Coast to export Canadian crude. Security concerns will reinforce the shift in Mexico's politics in support of developing its own shale gas, while its border response has been to double down on energy sovereignty through refining and investment in the state-owned oil company Pemex, a costly strategy that will take time. South America depends heavily on imported refined products, and higher fuel prices are creating fiscal and political pressures. However, the region has significant domestic oil and gas production, large renewable and hydropower resources, and several major sources of future oil and gas supply that lie outside the Gulf and are thus free from Hormuz risks. That makes the region more strategically valuable if Middle East supplies carry a higher risk premium. The interest in investing in countries such as Brazil, Guyana, and Argentina, which were already expected to drive much of the growth in non-OPEC supply over the next several years, will extend to other potential producers, such as Suriname. Venezuela is the wild card. As its new leadership seeks to attract foreign investment, exports approached 1 million barrels a day in March, the highest level since 2019, although significant risks remain. The repercussions for China have been mixed. China is a large net importer, and as oil prices rise and it loses access to discounted Iranian barrels, the cost to import barrels has risen sharply. China's April bill for crude oil imports was up 13% from a year earlier. Still, China holds large petroleum stockpiles as it curbs imports through the use of inventories and reduced refinery runs. China is also reselling crude it was contracted to buy to other countries, often at a profit. The crisis will reinforce, not upend, Beijing's energy strategy. China spent years curbing the growth of oil use. Compared to the U.S. or Europe, petroleum makes up a smaller share of its primary energy mix, and it has electrified more of its automobiles and energy systems overall. China's 15th five-year plan, released just after the war started, called for becoming an energy powerhouse through strategic resilience and technological sovereignty with non-fossil sources. The disruption of oil and gas supplies would only strengthen those ambitions. India is more vulnerable than China. It imports nearly 90% of the crude it consumes, and before the war, roughly half of those barrels moved through Hormuz. The shock has forced New Delhi to lean harder on Russia, but not on the bargain terms it enjoyed after the Ukraine invasion. India has more fiscal capacity, larger inventories, and more diversified suppliers than its poorer neighbors such as Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. So it is unlikely to face the same shortages. But expensive crude worsens inflation, strains budgets, and raises the cost of shielding consumers. The country's longer-term response may require diversifying supply while accelerating oil displacement through solar batteries, electric vehicles, and rail. Japan is highly exposed to oil and gas disruptions. Imports need more than 85% of its energy consumption. And in 2025, nearly all of Japanese crude oil imports transited through Hormuz. Japan has been the second largest contributor to the International Energy Agency's emergency stock release after the U.S., making available the equivalent of roughly 70 days of Japanese consumption, an enormous drawdown by historical standards. The conflict is raising overall import costs and electricity prices at a time when Japanese consumers and businesses continue to struggle with inflation. As a resource-poor island that is heavily dependent on maritime trade for essential goods like food and energy, energy security has long been a serious policy concern in Japan. The crisis will reinforce these concerns and strengthen the case for restarting more nuclear reactors, accelerating offshore wind and solar, and improving grids, flexibility, and storage. But Japan's basic import vulnerability will remain, leading it to further prioritize energy efficiency, electrification of more of the economy, and maintain larger buffers against disruption. Few actors have benefited as visibly, at least in the short term, as Vladimir Putin. Before the war, Russia's oil export revenue had fallen to its lowest level since the start of the Ukraine invasion in 2022. Its economy appeared on the brink of recession. The Iran war has been a gift for Putin. The U.S. decisions to ease sanctions on Russian oil helped Moscow monetize already loaded barrels at higher prices, and Russia doubled its main source of oil tax revenue in April. The fiscal benefit has so far been similar, or pardon me, has so far been smaller than the oil price surge suggests, as part of the increase was offset by payments to oil companies to keep domestic fuel prices down. In the long run, Putin's windfall may prove short-lived. Ukrainian attacks and constraints on investments and technology have accelerated the long-term decline of Russia's oil industry, hampering its ability to structurally increase oil production capacity for the long term in response to today's higher prices. And Ukrainian attacks are intensifying, with at least 21 strikes on Russian assets and an infrastructure in April. Russia's refinery runs last month were the lowest since 2009. Most of Iran's neighbors are suffering major losses, but to different degrees. Saudi Arabia and the UAE are better positioned because they invested in pipelines to the Red Sea and Gulf of Oman, allowing each to bypass Hormuz for roughly half of its pre-war exports. Oman, located outside of the strait, has seen oil revenue rise 80% on a weekly basis compared with last year. Saudi revenue is up 10% despite reduced export volumes. By contrast, Iraq's exports have fallen sharply. Kuwait has exported little oil or refined products for 10 weeks. Qatar's liquefied natural gas exports are offline, and damage to some of the country's export facilities during the conflict could take considerable time to repair. As storage reaches capacity, Middle East producers have been forced to stop production at roughly 13 million barrels a day of output. Once the strait reopens, it could take months to restore that supply, especially in Iraq and Kuwait, where large mature fields and aging infrastructure make stoppage harder to reverse. for many producers. A priority will be reducing exposure to choke points through new pipelines and export routes that bypass Hormuz, and reaffirming they are a trustworthy supplier. Iran's position is complicated. It's losing substantial export revenue as the U.S. blockade hinders crude shipment. But in the early phase of the crisis, may have benefited from higher prices and temporary sanction relief. With some of its barrels sold far above the discounts, the company had accepted on the black market because its oil fields and export infrastructure on Kong Karg Island appear to have suffered relatively little damage. Iran may have restored exports relatively quickly if and when the strait reopens. Tehran may emerge with new leverage. It has floated the idea of charging a toll to keep the strait open. Even if the war ends without such an arrangement, Iran has demonstrated that its ability to block Hormuz may be as powerful as the threat of a nuclear weapon. Europe imports far less crude through Hormuz than Asia does, but it faces higher costs as competition intensifies for available barrels. When it comes to oil products such as jet fuel, Europe is particularly vulnerable, owing to its dependence on Middle East imports. The head of the International Energy Agency warned in middle April that Europe has maybe 6 weeks of jet fuel left, after which consumers will see even higher fares and more canceled flights. By contrast, electricity prices, which soared during the 2022 crisis, are not significantly higher, as the initial natural gas price spike has eased and alternative sources of power have picked up some of the slack. European governments have begun discussing voluntary conservation measures. Much like the 2022 energy crisis following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, this one will reinforce Europe's imperative to electrify more of the economy with domestic power sources, including by reconsidering opposition to nuclear energy in some countries. But this strategy creates another vulnerability. A dependence on China for solar panels, batteries, electric vehicles, and critical mineral processing, which a recent report from a former UK national security official and leading China scholar suggest could create its own risk. Oil and gas exports in North, West, and Central Africa, including Algeria, Libya, Nigeria, and Angola, may benefit from higher prices and new investments in production. Much harder hit are oil importers closer to the Gulf, including Egypt, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Zambia. Many countries, even some producers, import much of the refined fuel they consume. Higher crude prices raise the cost of diesel, gasoline, cooking fuel, transport, and food, while governments have limited fiscal room to cushion the blow. The crisis will strengthen the case for both refineries and renewables. There are allegedly plans to build a massive new refinery in East Africa, and countries such as Ghana, Angola, and Uganda may quickly follow suit. For Africa's poorest importers, every mini-grid, solar farm, battery, and electric bus that displaces fuel imports reduces exposure to the next oil shock. Though high borrowing costs, currency risk, and weak grids remain major constraints, this situation will likely expand China's existing investments in these industries in Africa. An increased demand for Chinese products such as solar panels, inverters, and batteries. The longer the Iranian war continues, the more divided the energy world will become across geopolitical and geographic fault lines. China will cast the conflict as proof that American hegemony has become a source of global instability rather than order, while heightened anxiety over oil and gas risk pushes more countries toward the clean energy technologies Beijing controls. Wealthy countries will respond by diversifying supply, strengthening buffers, and accelerating alternatives, while poorer ones will often be forced to choose what is cheapest rather than most secure. Importers will pay a premium for diversified supply, while exporters will pay for routes to market that are less vulnerable to disruption. Here in the U.S., perhaps the biggest lesson is that even the world's largest producers cannot insulate themselves from shocks in a global market. Another first page article is this: the mayor's video, Ken Griffin's threat, and the future of New York City. It's written by Kevin Dugan. Wall Street, by and large, laid low in its criticisms of Zoran Mandemi, first few months at New York City mayor. While many loathed the tax, the rich rhetoric that colored his campaign, there were brief glimmers that the Democratic Socialist could be less doctrinaire as mayor than they had feared, vowing to build hundreds of thousands of new residences, cutting red tape, and even participating in photo ops with President Trump. But the detente did not last. If Mandemi stepped into an early self-made crisis last month, to his many critics in the finance industry, it was a predictable one. In a video posted on Tax Day, the mayor stood outside a luxury apartment building on Central Park South to deliver a message about a new pied de terre tax. This is an annual fee on luxury properties worth more than $5 million, whose owners do not live full-time in the city. The mayor said this as a camera panned to the top floor of the building. Succession-style music playing in the background. Like for this penthouse, he said, looking up, which hedge fund CEO Ken Griffin bought for $38 million. To those in Griffin's milieu, or who aspire to be, the video was a distasteful, even dangerous broadside against the city's wealthy. It was about being punitive, said Stephen Fulop, CEO of the Partnership for New York City, a business advocacy group. Being punitive in this environment is a scary thing, and unnecessary and unbecoming of a mayor who should be bringing people together. Investors including Bill Ackman and Dan Loeb expressed outrage that the mayor would call out Griffin. Stephen Roth, the Vornado CEO, compared the tax the rich slogan to a racial slur. Griffin himself called the video creepy and weird, publicly contemplating pulling out of anchoring a new building at 350 Park Avenue. President Trump eventually weighed in. You don't want to lose people like Ken. That would be a big loss for New York. Despite his part-time status, Griffin is a fixture in New York. His name is above an atrium at the American Museum of Natural History and a wing at the Museum of Modern Art. Citadel Securities, his market-making firm, plays an integral role at the New York Stock Exchange. He's helping to build a new Midtown skyscraper. Mandami, who has shown himself to be a master of crafting the narrative around him, churning out social media videos and cutting an image of a government at work, was put on the defensive while the billionaires, weeks later, are still working the business circuit trying to tip the narrative in their favor. They've painted the mayor as a divisive and a governing lightweight. New York no longer welcomes success, as Griffin said at a recent investor conference. Griffin, who famously pulled his business out of Chicago, citing rising crime and moved to Florida, has vowed to shift more of his jobs to Miami, with some billionaires supporting him. He has to do what he has to do, said John Katsimatsis, the billionaire CEO of Red Apple Group, whose radio station has become an oasis for anti-Mandami New Yorkers. I understand how he feels, and yet there's a joke circulating on Wall Street that if Mandami hadn't mentioned Griffin by name, the hedge fund manager, worth an estimated $48 billion, probably would not have noticed his hefty tax bill. What could have been a minor dust-up has now compounded into a very public fight that pits Mandami and his affordability agenda against titans of Wall Street, who oversee an industry that is the city's economic engine, accounting for one out of every $5 in economic activity, according to a state comptroller's report. In private, Mandami has sought to lower the temperature. People familiar with his conversation said he has told business leaders, in effect, that he wouldn't put Griffin's name in a video if he could do it again. I'm a little bit surprised at the staying power of the story, said Julie Sue, the deputy mayor for economic justice. This is not about any one individual. The day after the tax day video, when Mandami was asked about the tax, he no longer mentioned Griffin and instead uses Saudi billionaire and a Russian car dealer as examples. When the mayor mentioned Griffin again a few days later, it was to thank him for funding a 9/11 memorial. Mandami's office has reached out to Griffin directly since the video was posted, Sue said, adding that the two have not spoken since the video dropped. Griffin also has not left. Mandami isn't the first sitting New York mayor to single out one of the city's business elite. Ed Koch needled Donald Trump for years when he was a mere real estate developer over tax breaks and Trump's own planned development for NBC. He called him Piggy, Piggy, Piggy. In 2004, Michael Bloomberg, himself among the city's richest, lambasted former Cablevision executive Charles and James Dolan for trying to block the construction of a stadium on Manhattan's west side, which they viewed as competition to their Madison Square Garden. Bloomberg even called on the city's campaign finance board to investigate whether their anti-stadium ad spending was running afoul of election laws, though nothing ever came of it. Mandami's rhetoric around taxes and class feels different this time, because it's attached to a broader political perspective of Mandami's, one that seems to resonate with the public, said Kim Phillips Fine, a professor of history at Columbia University and the author of Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. Cook or Bloomberg? These are people who are not campaigning. And organizing around programs of economic redistribution. But personal political attacks have taken on a new form in the Trump era, starting with the president himself. Among the billionaires name-checked by Trump on his own Truth Social feed are Jeff Bezos, for coverage in the Washington Post, Jamie Dimon over debanking allegations, and Elon Musk. Crazy. Political violence is also a feature of the era. Noting the animus toward corporate America is not to be taken lightly, say executives. In the past 2 years, the CEO of United Health's insurance arm was shot in the street, and there was another shooting at the city's Blackstone headquarters. In April, a man was charged with setting fire to a Kimberly-Clark warehouse in California over what authorities allege was anti-capitalist sentiment. Also that month, a man threw a Molotov cocktail at the home of OpenAI CEO Sam Altman. Trump, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, and Nancy Pelosi's husband have also survived attempts on their lives in recent years. Today is a very different environment, said Philip. The access to social media, the access to rhetoric around violence, the actions around violence, are all different in 2026 than they were in 1998. The pied-à-terre tax is something of a compromise to a compromise. In Mamdani's early months, he attempted to raise taxes on corporations and those who make over $1 million in line with his campaign promises. When Albany balked, he floated a 9.5% city tax on property owners to help plug a $5 billion budget hole. Governor Kathy Hochul, who oversees the city's ability to raise taxes and is up for re-election this year, ultimately included the smaller tax on luxury second homes in her budget, reviving a plan once touted by her predecessor and the mayor's election year rival, Andrew Cuomo. On Tuesday, the day Mamdani announced his first budget as mayor, he released a new video. "We taxed the rich," he said in the clip, which references a snippet of the Griffin's video. His budget would be $127 billion funded in part by this pied de terre tax, which is expected to move ahead. "I sincerely think if the mayor could go back, he would do it differently. I have reason to believe, let me just say it that way." Phillips said that New York's CEOs are frustrated that the mayor's private mea culpas and his public boasts don't match up. Sue said he hadn't heard Mamdani say he could do the video differently. "One really important start or part of earning trust in governing well is to say the same thing in private that you say in public. And the mayor and I have been clear, and we believe that the wealthy can afford to pay more." To Mandani's supporters, both the new tax and the battle with the billionaires might be the fighting words they voted for. But how far the fight escalates remains to be seen. Mamdani spent the past weeks in meetings with the CEOs of Bank of America and Kobani, the president of Blackstone and other executives, and trade groups. Sue said that her conversations with CEOs have focused on areas where they could work together, including how to make the city more livable. Other investors, such as Andrew Murstein, whose firm Medallion Financial lends to New York City yellow cab owners, are trying to prevent business leaders from leaving the city. "Abandoning New York now," Murstein said, "would be the real strategic error." You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As we get near the end, here's an article by Pamela Paul entitled "A Former Navy SEAL on How to Raise Competent, Risk-Taking Kids." Brandon Webb is talking the way parents do when their kids aren't around, tallying their strengths and foibles, failures and wins, and the extent to which his own shortcomings as a father may have contributed. Much of this self-appraisal is detailed in his 10th book, Puddle Jumpers: Powerful Mental Techniques from a Navy SEAL Performance Coach and Father of Three, which comes out next week. About halfway into the conversation, over Zoom from an airbomb in the French Alps, it becomes clear that two of those kids, Jackson 24 and Madison 21, both pseudonyms used in the book, have been flitting in and out of the room for the whole time. They occasionally pop on screen to fact-check or elaborate on their father's responses to questions. This was the most fun and fastest book I've ever written, Web 51 says. The author of the memoir, The Red Circle, and The Killing School, Inside the World's Deadliest Sniper Program, never imagined he'd write a parenting book. I cried 3 or 4 times while writing. What made him cry? Just these vulnerable moments with my kids. Madison, failing to pass her purple belt test in Taekwondo. His son, Tyler, also a pseudonym, now 19, getting kicked off the basketball team. The letter Jackson wrote to his parents explaining why he was going to the prom, despite being grounded over an incident the family dubbed Operation Weed. They were like, oh no, my friends. Parents are going to read this. But they've been really good sports about it, Webb says. What is a puddle jumper? One of my early memories as a father was when Tyler was 5 or 6 and wanted to jump in this nasty, dirty mud puddle just as we were coming off a day on the slopes in Tahoe. I was like, don't you dare. But then I realized, what do I care? So I have to do an extra load of laundry. I realized I want to raise kids who are going to jump in mud puddles. That's a joyful, confident kid who wants to jump into life. We were an elite, you were an elite sniper with the Navy SEALs. Can you explain how those principles align with child rearing? A lot of it is about mental management and self-talk. When I was teaching snipers, I realized you can't point out mistakes, especially in front of other people, because they spread like a virus. A common one is in flinching on a high-powered rifle. If I say to a trainee, you're flinching, that puts it in his head. When we introduced changes to training to focus on positive psychology, our 30% failure rate went down to 1%. When I left the Navy, I said, why can't this apply to parenting? What would you think of one of your kids going through Hell Week? Hell Week is just a personal journey of suffering. You can't fake it. You have to go through it and earn it. But there are times I wish they had experienced more hardship, because I think that builds character. When Tyler got kicked off the basketball team, for example, there are a lot of parents who would go to the coach and say, how dare you? But we took the feedback seriously, and it was brutal. It's tough to watch your kids suffer, but then the world is tough. And it is not always fair. They've got to learn to deal with this stuff. What's the biggest misconception people have about what a military parent might be like? That we're over-strict, harsh. I remember when I coached Little League, the other parents were scared. Someone said to me, maybe send an email out to the parents and let them know I'm not going to be putting them through boot camp and making them do push-ups and screaming at them. If anything, combat veterans are more empathetic. They've seen the worst of human nature. And that actually makes them very caring parents. How do you differentiate between discipline and punishment? Punishment is when a parent acts out of a fear response, whereas discipline is more thoughtful. You want to take your own emotion out of it and get to the why behind the kid's behavior and respond to that. But I'm a bigger believer in consequences too. Kids know if you're bluffing. So do not make a threat that you're not willing to carry through. Once I was taking the kids to SeaWorld and they were misbehaving in the car. I said, if you keep that up, we're not going to SeaWorld. When they kept going, I took the next turn off the highway. When we finally went back 2 weeks later, they were all quietly reading in the back seat. They need to know that you're not messing around. Who is the reader you had in mind when writing this book? I keep seeing these successful parents who obviously love their kids and give in too much. You can't focus solely on your career and outsource being a parent and then wonder why your kids are going in a really dark direction. Some high-performing parents need a splash of water in the face. Explain what the phrase, do it for dad, means in your family. It's my fatherly nudge to do something that they're a little nervous or apprehensive about, like the double black diamond. Or even trying a new food. What does it mean to you to be a good father? I want to be the kind of dad that my kids look back on and think, I was present and loving and the kind of person they'd look up to. It's such a rewarding thing as a parent to have this kind of friendship with your grown kids. There's a new book out this week. It's called simply Nolan, N-O-L-A-N, the name. It's written by Tim Brown. This book review is written by David Shredman, who's the former executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and a scholar in residence at Carnegie Mellon University. Nolan is about Nolan Ryan. By these modern records, shall baseball fans know him? Seven no hitters. 5,714 career strikeouts and 383 strikeouts in a single season. Alas, 8 seasons leading the league in walks as well. And that can only be Lynn Nolan Ryan Jr., better known as Nolan Ryan, who joined the majors in 1966 and pioneered the art of throwing at triple-digit speeds. Mr. Ryan pitched for 4 different clubs, the New York Mets, the California Angels, the Houston Astros, and the Texas Rangers, across 27 seasons, before earning a bronze plaque in the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 1999. We in the bleachers already know about the career. In Nolan, the singular life of an American original. Tim Brown introduces us to a small-town boy from Alvin, Texas, who married his high school sweetheart and absorbed the lore of the Lone Star State from the books of J. Frank Dobie. Mr. Brown, a veteran baseball writer, isn't merely concerned with the flame-throwing right-hander's exploits on the mound. Mr. Ryan once complained that all he really knew about Walter Johnson, who won 417 games as a pitcher in the early 20th centuries, were the stats he saw in reference to the book. It didn't say too much about the man. Mr. Brown's book does. Mr. Ryan emerges as a hand worker when he was a work in progress, a mentor as a veteran, a young man with dyslexia who could read the instincts of batters, a gentleman on the street, had a demon out of, or pardon me, a gentleman on the street. But a demon in the diamond. Mr. Brown describes the Elvin of Mr. Ryan's youth as a little place with mostly fields of green and dirt that seemed 1,000 miles from anywhere of consequence. As a boy, Mr. Ryan had his own cow and fed it by hand. He said a high point of his early life was buying a baseball glove with his father at the local hardware store. The purchase was made a half block from the post office, now the site of a museum exhibit dedicated to Mr. Ryan. He became a pitcher for a very logical reason. His older brother was a catcher. The book is filled with many great human nature stories about Nolan Ryan. He retired in 1993, and George W. Bush, then the managing general partner of the Rangers, said the exit of the team's ace was the passing of an era. I wish he could have pitched for us forever. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the most recent issue of the Wall Street Journal Review. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Thursday at 7 p.m. Your reader has been Don Swans.
The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability,